You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, December 19th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not in the literal nor in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times, but instead steps away from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. In fact, brace yourselves. This is the final Casual Friday of the year. So weird. It seems like we're months away from the end of the year, but in fact, we are two short Fridays away. Joining us for the final Friday of the year is the man who joined us for nearly every Friday of the year, Mr. Cliff Schechter. And also on the program today, promoting and, well, I don't know, promoting is the right word. I am celebrating his return, not quite to the airwaves, but to the internet waves. What was that? What did I coin it yesterday? Internet waves? Internet waves. Tom Sharpling. Of formerly the best show on FMU, now just from the best show, I think. All that on today's program. Also on the program today, Cuba, fracking, President Obama's judiciary record, Vermont, single payer, not gonna happen. That sucks. Mentioned it on the funner half yesterday. Also, a big push to get the overtime threshold risen, and some questions as to whether or not it was North Korea actually involved in this hack of Sony, and the NYPD, the benevolent, the policeman's benevolent associate. Oh, God, whatever. We'll get into it. I don't know what's wrong with these guys. But apparently there's a 5 p.m. There's a rally to support the NYPD. And you know what? I don't like the attitude. This is what bums me out about this stuff is that I am supportive of the NYPD. There are elements of it that are very problematic, however.
I hope you are supportive of us. You look like you've been getting your lunch money stolen for a long time.
And
look the other way, Mr. Cedar, when your Jew glasses get pushed off your nose. I expect you to see there at 5.
Jesus. Wow. We're really out of the gate today. It's 60 miles an hour. Well, we'll talk about this.
Dante de Blasio to mug you? Okay. Yeah.
Go. Good luck. Good luck to you.
Run a freaking revolution out of this place.
Unbelievable. But we will get to all that and more. And also, good news. Lastly, good news for transgender workers of the federal government. The U.S. government is now going to extend protections, non-discriminatory protections to them, and also is has changed their position on Title VII of the Federal Civil Rights Act. So we will get to that on this program as well. A couple of points. First off, let me just say that today I'm extremely casual in my dress. I am wearing a V-neck T-shirt and a zippered sweater. And I'm making a point of pointing this out because it was a birthday present from my sister. And so I wanted her to have the opportunity to see that. Now, of course, she knows the wardrobe, right? Well, wrong. No, what she gave me initially was a frosted blue V-neck sweater that I felt was a little bit it looked like one of those, like, golf sweaters. I don't have anything wrong with a golf sweater, but it looked like something that, like, a 65-year-old it looks like something that my uncle grandfather, my uncle, I guess, is now 70s, late 70s. It looked like something that, like, my grandfather or my uncle would wear. And I said, this color is not for me. And so I returned it and got this ensemble, which is extremely, it's just very fashion forward for me. It's got a little design right here and a zipper and a could be like this. So I just wanted to point that out for my sister's sake. And also to remind you folks that here's what the schedule is going to be. Next week, we're going to be doing a show on Monday. We may do a pre-tape show for Tuesday, but I'm not sure about that. We also, on Wednesday, we will also have pre-tape material, maybe from Ring of Fire. And then we will either be doing 4 or 5 days of best ofs next week. The
week after next.
Yeah, the week after next. Or we may do one on Friday and then extend it in. I'm not sure exactly how this is going to go. But we will see. So this is definitely the last live Friday show of the year. And just a reminder, you can support this program in 2015 and beyond by becoming a member today at majority.fm. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. I don't know. Last night I went to go see, I took Myla, it's one of her Hanukkah presents, to, the Nutcracker in Brooklyn. And she loved it. And that music is not from the Nutcracker, but it reminded me of that. But speaking of music that reminds me of something, I believe that we have a little ditty that reminds me as to who is our upcoming guest.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter. LibertasLLC.com.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, for the final Friday of the year. It seems weird, doesn't it, Cliff?
It does. I can't accept that time goes as quickly and my time with you ends, Sam.
You know,
I mean, not forever, unless something tragic should befall us, which hopefully it won't. But I mean, you know, for the year.
For the year. And you know, last year felt like it was we buttoned it so nicely. But this year, because of when Christmas is falling and New Year's is falling midweek, it becomes very complicated. And
what's up with that crap anyhow?
I don't know. It's very strange. And so, you know, and I follow, as I'm sure you do, our lives are dictated by our kids. And so our vacations are a function
also
of
Dick
our
Cheney.
And Dick Cheney. And and of course, you know, North Korean hackers or non-North Korean hackers.
Right.
You know, so I'm heading to Michigan midweek next week. And then,
oh, you'd be just north of me. Why are you heading up there, Sammy?
Well, you know, I have in-laws there. And
oh, I didn't know that. Wife's from there, huh?
Indeed, yes.
Which part of that wonderful and cold state are you headed to?
Around the Ann Arbor area, and Ann Arbor and that area, yes.
That's a nice area, at least.
Indeed, it is. I spend a lot of time intoxicated. As a way of,
I recommend that too,
of dealing with the in-laws, and that's, I mean, not that I love my in-laws, that's great, but they all seem to be intoxicated too, so it makes it easy.
It's a very inviting family, it sounds like.
I will say this: I have never. It wasn't until I went to Michigan did I ever realize that people actually have wet bars in their basements.
Yeah, you got to spend more time out in this part of the country, Sam. It's,
Everybody had a wet bar in their basement.
And, of course, while you're headed out to the wet bars of America to be a real American, I'm headed back to be an elitist in New York.
There you go.
Where I grew up.
It's an effing revolution here.
It is.
Well, the upside
nicely
is –
nicely put, by
and
the way.
This is a great way to segue into this. I just want to touch on this briefly. Because fracking ban in New York State, I think it's a pretty big deal. Not just because for a number of reasons.
You're saying when I get there, the water will taste a little bit better than the last time.
Well, there's been a ban for a while, but it's going to be the water's sure to be good moving forward. Let's put it that way.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And that's interesting, actually. I mean, all seriousness, I wasn't aware that there was currently a ban in place. I thought there were some exceptions to that ban.
Well, it's more or less a moratorium, so there has, you know, the fracking, they've been zeroing in on it, but now we're not going to get it there, and it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, there's two things that come out of this for me. One is that because it was based on health issues, that this may be somewhat of a precedent, or at least somewhat of an argument in other states or across the country. The other is, and then, you know, and all this must be taken with a grain of salt because the dollar amounts that are involved are less because of the price of oil these days, and the sort of the abundance of natural gas. But the other issue is that, you know, you can see the value of that Zephyr Teachout run in watching Cuomo respond to it.
Right. Well, a lot of the people who were behind her were a lot of sort of anti-frackers who organized. And so that was huge. And again, this is why people don't realize that you don't have to run and win to make a difference. I wish she had run if she'd gotten in a couple months earlier. Because I think that she could have won that race. And it's also why I explain to people when people sit around, whether it's presidential elections or anything else, and they say, oh, well, such and such has no chance or such and such is guaranteed. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard those very words in politics, you know, when it's absolutely not true. I mean, if you don't look back very far back in history, there was a point where Ronald Reagan was a joke and Bill Clinton was in third place and was losing in the primaries and then in third place behind Bush and Perot. And we could get more recent and go on and on and on. You just don't know. You don't know what's going to happen. And so I wish she'd gotten in earlier, but I still think that when she did get in, that made an enormous difference. It helped bring out activists. It helped shape a message as to who Andrew Cuomo stood for in New York. I'm still, I have to admit, kind of shocked he did this. I don't remember this was part of his deal with the Working Families Party, but it's not like he's respected any of that deal anyhow. You know, I'm shocked. I would have expected that that he, you know, that he would have just gone forward with it because, A, to say screw you to the left, because he's very much a Joe Lieberman type that way, and seems to get off on that, and you know, B, because I'm sure there's some energy interest that'd be willing to pay him off, and he doesn't seem to have a problem with anybody paying him off.
I think the anti-fracking fracking activists are so widespread, and particularly upstate, obviously, that I think the calculation was different from for him. And yes, you know, I was a little bit surprised too. I'm waiting for the next shoe to fall, where he basically says, we're going to aim for 75% privatized schools in this state by 2025 right. or something. But now I want to flip. I want to just flip this, because and I don't know that we had planned to talk about this. And I know that we want to get to, obviously, to Cuba and to Jeb and to the overtime issue and, you know, look into 2015 a little bit. But Vermont announced yesterday, or I should say the governor, Shumlin, announced that that single payer, that the, and we have been talking about this for years now, right? For four
right.
years, that
right.
Vermont was going to get a waiver to attempt a single payer. I have talked about it with a lot of different healthcare experts over the years, and the big thing that people were waiting on was them finding a funding mechanism. And a lot of things conspired to it falling apart up there. But one of them, and we can get into to those things, not the least of which Jonathan Gruber becomes a you know, sort of an albatross, I guess, on some level, because he was up there consulting on how to get financing. And
right.
And a caller yesterday said, you know, the problem with single payer advocates is that they need to be upfront about the tax increases so that they can have arguments for it and why it's necessary, and so that it doesn't come as a shock. But the big issue, it seems to me, is that you've got a governor, a Democratic governor in Vermont, who didn't even get at the 50% threshold.
That's
and
true.
So was
and
not the, even technically.
The legislature had to vote him in because that's
exactly
the law
right.
There.
That's exactly right. They don't do a runoff. They had the legislature. So this guy wasn't even technically reelected by the voters, and that means the guy has no political capital whatsoever. And so the idea that he was going to try and sell Vermonters on a 10% increase in taxes was extremely far-fetched from that position of weakness. You know, I mean, and you know, we saw what it did with Al Franken, who won by 200 votes or whatever it was. For the next 6 years, he had to be very circumspect. You know, I think when you factor in that aspect of it, he did well. But this, your vote margin impacts, rightly or wrongly, what is perceived as your political cash. And
there's no doubt about that. I mean, that's why Cuomo wanted to run up the score in New York and sell out everything to the centristy guys that could fund his campaign with all the slush fund money.
And that's why when he didn't get that, he has to capitulate to the frackers.
That, right. I mean, that's exactly. That is a big reason why. And that's why before the wonderful bridges of Fort Lee County – sorry, I couldn't help myself. You know, Chris Christie was trying to run up the score in New Jersey to propel himself into a presidential race. I mean, this is what they do, and that's the way the media treats it. I mean, they break down how much you won by, and then that makes you a big star. So there's no doubt that with Shumlin that's harmful. Although I would have thought, I guess I'm wrong, that they've got a pretty progressive state legislature up there that I thought would have stepped up to support it too. But I guess they need kind of his microphone
exactly.
behind it.
If Shumlin wins by 75% to 25%, let's say. I mean, I don't know that that was ever possible, but then he goes to the state legislatures and says, look, you vote for this. I got your back. I'm going to go out. I'm going to go to your town. I'm going to make you look very popular. I'm going to help you. You know, I mean,
right.
that's you know, that is what, you know, people have to understand that the reasons why your vote are many of them. And so, yes, voting for someone who you know is going to lose still can have value. Voting for someone and can also have dangers, too. I mean, we've
right.
talked about this. Voting for someone who you know is going to win can have value. I mean, every situation is different and it has different implications, but there's always implications, or there always can be ones that you really got to look down the road to see in certain circumstances. And, you know, it's obviously, you know, part of the reason these two stories, I think, are opposite sides of the same coin. Looking at the stuff in potentially drafting Elizabeth Warren is another factor involved in this. And, you know, I'm going to talk to Digby about that, I think, a little bit more next week. So I'm not sure I want to spend too much time on that. But
you're saying that's another factor in what? Specifically.
Well, I mean, you know, drafting Warren and, you know, does this inhibit her power in the Senate insofar as it makes people think that she's only doing this stuff because she's preening for a potential presidential run? Does it diminish her if she doesn't run, even though she's made it clear that she doesn't want to run? Does it inhibit her leverage? You know, Al Franken came out this week and endorsed Hillary. And part of that, I'm not convinced, part of the reason why he felt sort of he had to do this now was maybe in some way so that there would be less speculation about Warren. And I'm not convinced that he wasn't doing that as a solid to Warren.
He's been a friend of the Clintons going back. I mean, Franken is clearly more progressive than they are, but he's been friendly with the Clintons going back a while.
I'm not saying that he wouldn't have come out.
But I would be surprised if somebody over there reached out to him and said, we need somebody progressive to endorse Hillary right
now. Oh, no, I don't even think that's – I would be, in fact, it wouldn't surprise me if someone from Warren's camp said, there's pressure on us and everybody to come out and endorse Hillary now. Give away any leverage that we might have to hold it back a little bit later. I mean, you know, this stuff seems like trivial and petty, and it may not be the case, but, you know.
No, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility, just like the other scenario that I said.
Exactly.
You know, there's politics, you have to always sit there and really analyze, because there always can be a couple different things going on. So,
but
it is interesting.
I mean, all of that is stuff, you know, and this is all stuff that we're going to be dealing with in 2015. So in some ways, it's sort of like a part of our looking forward. And
are you leaning forward, Sam?
I'm sometimes, very rarely these days, but on occasion I do. But this is certainly the place for politics.
Oh, easily.
Anyways.
Easily.
All right, so let's talk about, I mean, looking forward to, and I want to look back for a moment and obviously and talk about this Cuba stuff, but I do want to touch on this overtime thing. And I know you are doing some work for Nick Hanauer, who I had the chance to interview on Ring of Fire, and it's going to play this weekend, but we're going to play it again next week. I've interviewed him on this program as well. And one of the things that he's working on now is pushing this overtime thing, which I didn't know much about at all. Set it up for us. I talk about it at length with Hanauer, but I want to talk to you about it because this is
in the wheelhouse here of what we talk about. Yes. It's simple common sense, and you know, essentially what you've got is, President Obama. I mean, we clearly through this Congress. We haven't been able to get anything at all through them. We're certainly not getting anything through them next year. Very little of any value. Let's put it that way. And so clearly, the president has been showing that he can use the key parts of that office the Constitution allows: executive orders, like with immigration, and the diplomacy, like with Cuba, which we'll get to. And I kind of see this as completing that trifecta, which is. You know, he stood up. Nick was one of the guys who fought for the minimum wage to go to $15 in Seattle, which is where he's based. And that was successful. And that sort of sent out a warning, you know, across the bow of businesses, these right-wing Koch brothers type organizations across the country that people want this. And the minimum wage was voted up in a number of states, too. But people have been pushing that. But the argument that Nick makes, and I think it's a brilliant one, is that essentially the overtime pay is kind of for middle class working Americans what the minimum wage is for the working poor, which is that people have been working longer hours, making less money, and they always say they feel that way, and the truth of the matter is because it's true. You know, as always, you have to chart back to right before Reagan, because everything started to go to crap when Reagan came in. In 1975, overtime, 65% of salaried workers got overtime. We've now fallen to the point where only 11% get it. or is that in real terms? It means that only people who make up to $23,600 a year make it. So, which is insane.
The thing that people should understand why that's the case. It's because there was a threshold that set. This is just like one of those, like, you know, very small bore regulations in the Department of Labor. We're going to say anybody who makes X amount of dollars, and we do this all the time, right? I mean, the level of poverty is set.
Defining rules in different departments, and that's what this is, defining what a rule means, the Department of Labor.
And in 1975, the threshold was set at a certain place, and it hasn't kept pace with inflation. And
right.
So
it's kind of like what's happened with the minimum wage, but the difference is you need Congress for that. Because this is defining a rule and the president, that's the president's prerogative, President Obama, with the stroke of a pen, could give us a second stimulus, the kind of thing we've been asking for forever and wanting and knowing we can't get through this Congress. 10.4 million, if he does what Nick wants him to do and what Nick's been pushing for and others who believe the same thing, essentially he would triple that threshold so people making up to $69,000 a year could get overtime pay. And then there's also the classification for how it is, you know, right now, anybody classified as an executive or in a managerial position can be excluded. But there's all sorts of people playing games with that, who they define as managerial. So if you broaden who can fall under overtime as opposed to, you know, making those categories more narrow, and if you triple that threshold to 69,000, you, as I said, 10.4 million people could get more money in their pockets. Around the holiday season now and next year. And so, I mean, you could be looking at it, not only does this help the middle class, it's been obviously hit in so many different ways, most recently with that Cromnibus bill, but it also, it really would help in terms of their consumer confidence. It helped put money in their pockets.
As Hannah was explaining to me, and I don't want to, make the entire interview irrelevant, although, it was a good conversation, but, you know, the other option is –
he's a fascinating guy, so he's worth listening to. And I'm not just saying that because I work with him. I work with him because he's a fascinating guy and
The other option is that employers say, I don't want to pay time and a half to have these two workers work 60 hours a week. I'm going to hire a third person.
and employment goes down.
Exactly. And so you start to bring in line, sort of wages with productivity. On some level. I mean, it's not a panacea,
right.
But it's one of those small things.
Raise wages, and wages have been flat. That's been the biggest. Everything that has really improved in our economy recently, with good economic growth and unemployment going down, with the stock market doing well and a number of other positive indicators, the one thing that has not really improved is wages. They've stayed mostly flat. This is another way, like raising the minimum wage, is another way that you help raise wages, and that's so. The thing again, it's key is people need to hear from President Obama needs to hear from people. And what's been great, he wrote a great piece for The Hill. It was picked up at Digby's Place and Daily Coast. They had something on Daily Coast actually put up a link, which I would love it if you would do, Sam, if you're kind enough to do it, to a petition. To get people to sign this petition and to call President Obama and say,
definitely,
you know what, this is with the stroke of a pen,
and it's also easy. There's also like a threefer element to this too, because let's transition to Cuba. It seems like every 4 days now, 5 days, maybe every 10 days, the president just does something that
sends the right just careening towards suicidal impulses.
I mean, we were joking about this, I think, in the better half yesterday, that it's basically he's like, here's the deal. I'm gonna do this, and I'm gonna say to Fox News, you're gonna get a ratings bump, and so he's doing both ends of this. I mean, that's the negotiation.
I think if I had been him over the past 6 years, if I had gone through what he has gone through in terms of, I'm not saying there weren't other things he could have done better, but I'm saying even if he had done things better, even if he'd done more by executive order and with appointments and things of that sort, still these guys would have been blocking a whole lot of stuff for the past 6 years. Just whatever he happened to say, whatever he happened to do, and their goal to make him a one-termer and their latent racism and the rest. So I think if I were him right now, I would just say I got two goals left. well, I'm going to do as much good as I can do through the executive office to help people. And if I can tie that in with as much as can piss off the very people that have tried to screw my presidency, I'm going to do those two things.
Well, it's interesting.
That's what I would do.
It'll be interesting to see if that he can maintain this sort of pace, right? I mean, because clearly it is he has these 2 months have gone very differently. And it's not even been 2 months, it's been 6 weeks since the election, than anyone would have predicted, I think, in terms of just sort of, I mean, aside from all of the policy implications of these moves, from in terms of a narrative type of situation, you haven't seen the obituaries, the political obituaries right. for Obama that you would have anticipated.
But the lame duck, there's nothing left for him to do because he basically got up and did things right away.
Right.
Again, some of them, like the immigration one, I wish he'd done sooner, might have helped us save a Senate seat in Colorado, might have helped us save 3 or 4 House seats. But in the end, he didn't, and he did it when he did, and that's still far better than not doing it. And the same with what's happened with Cuba, and I would throw again overtime pay in with that. You want to bring back
if he can do it.
White middle-class voters?
Right.
Well, overtime he can do. He just needs to sign the thing. I mean, there's nothing the Republicans can do. That's why we were encouraging people to reach out and contact him. It's all in his hands. If he's willing to do that. And I think, you know, who else are you trying to win back the coalition? I mean, again, it's good policy, good politics. You want to convince, you know, at least you know, a lot of the white middle class and others who've drifted away from the Democratic Party not to just vote on, you know, God, guns, and gays, to grab an old phrase. Well, you know, give them something. As we've said, give them something positive. Show them that you actually are on their side. This would be that kind of thing.
So in terms of Cuba, just turning back there, there's stories out
there. You and me, a couple cigars, checking out some baseball prospects next winter. What do you say?
Well, I mean, if I'm lucky if I can actually get down to like New Jersey, that far south. But there's not that, you know, the real question is going to be, I mean, so people should understand the embargo is not lifted. And to the extent the travel restrictions have been eased, it's not going to be terribly significant unless you have family there in many respects.
There's categories of travelers and none of them.
But none of those
under.
Are really that different.
I just feel like going for the hell of it. It's educational, journalists. There's a number of categories,
but those,
you really have
you know,
a specific reason.
Yeah, but yeah. Those haven't changed. I mean, I went down there 14 years ago or 12 years ago with my wife, who was shooting a documentary. We went down on an OFAC a license through the Treasury Department. It was to create a cultural product or something to that effect. I can't remember at the moment, but my mother has been there as a teacher, and I know other people. I mean, this doesn't seem that dramatic other than maybe the enforcement. I don't know. But what's interesting.
You're right, but I think, first of all, there's kind of what they allow and what they sort of officially put in writing and say, and that does make a difference because it sends a signal and it tells people that, you know, we're not looking at this as the same kind of place. We're not looking at this as a pariah state anymore. We are opening diplomatic relations.
Well, that's the big thing.
Yeah, the embargo is still there, yes. And, you know, travel has been loosened somewhat and what you can import has been loosened somewhat. But in the end, the key part of it is that what we're saying is that we're moving away from an obstinate, stupid policy. That literally, in the history of stupid policies in this country, this may be one of the dumbest. We forced Castro into a corner by doing what we did right out of the gate in 1959. We didn't give the guy a chance. I mean, you know, let's be honest here. The Castro brothers have done a lot of terrible things. They've hurt a lot of people. They never were the type of people I'd be like, hey, let's be good buddies with them. But you know what? We're friends with Saudi Arabia. See how many
China.
People they've
right.
they've executed in the town square, women, because they, you know, cheated on their husband or something. Or didn't. And so, I mean, friends aren't going to, you know, allies in this world are never going to be perfect. The point is that when you consider who we're friends with, the fact that right out of the gate, it was, well, you know, Bay of Pigs, and then we almost, you know, the world almost blew up over this island, you know, and that's not exaggerating during the Cuban Missile Crisis, because we learned later that Russian generals on the ground had the command authority to launch tactical nukes at us if we hit them. And think about all the idiocy around that policy that never needed to be. Whatever your vision of the Cold War was, Cuba was a small island off.
Well, it wasn't just about the Cold War, and you, the one thing that sums up why we reacted the way that we did to Castro is in the course of this documentary, one of the guys that we that Nikki interviewed, I should say. I mean, it's Nikki's film. I was just there, basically doing a lot of the sort of grunt work, but
did you get a credit at least?
I think I did.
Okay, good.
But one of the photographers who was hired to basically photograph him, you know, for propaganda value, had told us that he rode in the car with the Secret Service when Castro came to the UN back in the, what was it, in the early 60s or whatever it was. And his the Secret Service name for him, for Castro, was Sugar One. And so, you know, it gives you a real sense of
some of the sugar barons who are right over here, the FanJul brothers.
It's all about certain commodities that we didn't right want to, that we had powerful interests in this
you
country.
You see how Debbie Wasserman Schultz got where she is? Look up the FanJul brothers, everyone. And you know why she's one of the Democrats against lifting the embargo.
There you go.
But that wasn't just it, Sam. That is a big part of it. It also was, I mean, you know, they had Mario Diaz-Bolart, however you pronounce his name, on TV the other day, and he's like, you know, his mom was married to one of Castro's brothers. I mean, there's a family connection there, and literally they were deposed and Castro took over. And some of this has been that a lot of the angry Cuban elites that had to escape, who were big shots under Batista and, you know, owned all sorts of businesses that were shut down, were involved in government and were kicked out, that they came to this country and they gave money and they had
yes
influence and they lived in an electorally important
definitely
state. And that had a lot to do with it, too.
That's why we've maintained this embargo. The reason why we initially were fearful of Castro had less to do with concern about Cubans who were being disenfranchised and more had to do with our own business interests being disenfranchised. You'll recall Michael yesterday was talking about that scene in Godfather 2 where Batista welcomes all the business interests in Cuba, and you've got these, you know, these businessmen, these very staunch, you know, sort of straight-laced businessmen from the banana, the coffee, the sugar, and then
right
our friends from the gaming industry.
Right, they were about to turn that. They wanted to turn that into another Vegas. I mean, that was the plan.
Oh, well, they had.
And it was, but they were even going to do more than they had
right
done. I mean, they were going to expand, and then of course, you know, Michael saw that guy get shot in the street, got a little suspicious, gave Fredo a big kiss, he broke his heart. You know the rest.
Oh God, Fredo.
What a great movie.
Fredo,
I mean, I think Godfather 2, even better than the first one. Is
Fredo
what I mean
needs to go.
Sorry?
Fredo needs to go.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what a great movie.
Sorry,
I lost myself for a second. Go ahead.
That's all right. You know, it'll be interesting, but there was a poll that, I'm trying to think where I got this poll, but this poll just came out, I guess just the other day, actually. I don't know how recent it is, but this is the most telling stuff right here. This is a poll of the Cuban American community in Miami-Dade County, Florida. All right, so this is like the
most ground zero
yep
for what the base used to be of who is most against opening relations. Just for perspective for people,
exactly. 52% of the respondents oppose continuing the embargo. 52%. If Cuban Americans ages 18 to 29, 62% oppose the embargo.
I saw this poll, too. I do think this poll came out recently.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but I think so.
Now, this is what's really interesting. A large majority, 68%, favor reinstituting diplomatic relations with Cuba, which is essentially what the president is doing. That's basically all he's doing.
Right.
Younger respondents, 90%. And so what's
interesting
here,
you know what you have to do in that poll? I don't know if you saw the breakdowns, but to get to the point where you first get to a majority saying that we should not reinstitute diplomatic relations, you have to get to Cubans over 70 years old.
That's right.
And that tells you everything you need to know there. It's sort of like how old white people are the anchor of the Republican Party on almost every other issue. In this case, it's the same old people that just happen to be Cuban.
And what's fascinating is there's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure. There's going to be a lot of pressure on Congress now, right, to take the next step. We've already got diplomatic relations. You're going to get all sorts of pressure on Congress. Basically, most of the pressure, I think, is basically going to come from agribusiness,
Fat Burger. All those Republicans, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, 11 million people there, with a lot of needs. I mean, a lot of those farm state Republicans who, and others are very much in favor. I mean, you saw, Jeff Flake from Arizona was one of the ones there to meet, Gross, who was released. So this isn't, it's mostly on the Republican side. It's mostly, you've got sort of three groups. You've got those in Florida, and that includes, sadly, as I said, like Debbie Wasserman Schultz, some Democrats too. Then you've got those with national ambitions in the Republican Party who think that they'll lose in a primary, and then you've just sort of got the angry older Cuban and then older white base that still can't accept that, the Cold War is over and still just this new world, newfangled world just freaks them out. But, there's a lot. So there's even Rand Paul said he's in favor of it. He's going to run the primaries, obviously. There's just a lot of Republicans. I mean, this will pass. Marco Rubio and all the other Democrats, sadly, Bob Menendez, they can yell and scream and stamp their feet as much as they want. I haven't done a head count, but my guess is that you'd find half of the Republicans and most of the Democrats in favor of going forward with some sort of relations. Also, Lindsey Graham, I think you could throw in there, too, who started weeping about it, because my guess is in his addled mind, his thought process is if we do this with Cuba, Iran could be next, which, of course, we all say.
Now,
absolutely.
Now, this is what I get. This is what I get out of this. Rand Paul could be helped. This could help him in places like Iowa, where apparently there's a lot of farmers, right, who might want to sell some of their stuff to Cubans. Cubans, big rice market down there. I don't know how much rice is in Iowa, but and also from Rubio's perspective, it almost feels to me like he is just positioning for a vice presidential nomination, right? Because it's basically him signaling like, I can't compete in the presidential race, but I'm a great vice presidential nominee because.
Well, if you think over the last month, you have to give the most hysterical sort of "I got screwed" award by everything in the world to Marco Rubio, because first he's made to look powerless, and people are reminded of the fact that he betrayed the Republican base in immigration reform by what President Obama did. So he has to come out and pretend he's so angry about what President Obama did, which sounds patently fake to anybody who knows that he pretty recently was in favor of probably going even further than President Obama. That's part A. And part B, Jeb Bush gets into the race. So you've got somebody else sucking up for money from the same donors in competition, so he's not the Florida Republican dream. And then C, you've got this. And on this issue, he's going to find that he's in the minority, and the people in his own party are going to say, you're nuts. He's sort of, in a way, he's had all these, issues. He's had so many rugs pulled out from under him. I think his presidential hopes are pretty much done.
And yes.
So you're right. You probably see him positioning himself for
his bottled water sponsorship, though, still going strong.
Through the roof.
Now,
through the roof.
Let's just briefly touch on Jeb Bush before we just sort of wrap up, I guess, for 2014.
Oh, man.
Here's my theory about Jeb Bush. Okay.
Hasn't been working out a lot lately.
No. Here's my theory of Jeb Bush. I think Jeb Bush has decided, like, look, I am doing this for George P. I mean, you all remember, right? George Herbert Walker Bush.
Man, that's the dream candidate for them now.
Famously said, when he was trying to remember his grandkids, the little brown one. Well, the little brown one he was talking about was George P., who is now in his mid-30s.
Land commissioner in Texas.
He is in his mid-30s. And I think Jeb was basically like, look, I'm going to run. I'm going to make it look like I'm semi-serious. sometime at the end of the year, you know, I'm going to stick to my guns on everything, and I'm going to say that the Republican Party has left me. And I am basically going to gift to my son what was gifted to my older brother and what was gifted to me by my father and what was gifted to him by his father, Prescott Bush, which is I'm going to get a tour of the country.
And his father, who started Brown Brothers Harriman, and yeah.
A political tour of the country. And I'm going to show my son, like, look, here are people you're going to meet who are going to fundraise for you down the road. Here is the different parts of the country. This is where the Scots-Irish are. This is where the, this is where you got to get a little Jewy. This is where you got to get whatever it is, right? And that's basically what we're seeing here. And so, you know, all the talk about Jeb Bush, people should be afraid of it, but, you know, what people should be afraid of is if they want to be afraid of anything named Bush – that is actually walking around on two legs, it should be George P. And that's really going to be our kids' problem.
True. They're going to have to remind people what an a-hole he is.
Well, I guess actually we're talking now 20. It could be 2024.
It doesn't necessarily have to be that far off because land commissioner in Texas is apparently a very powerful position. And I'm not being sarcastic. I've heard that is true. Whereas governor is not, and that's where his uncle came from to become president. So it made the governor there purposely weak. From land commissioner, he's still from that. He could become. I mean, you could see it either in a term or two. He could become governor, and then he could run. You know, and he's in mid 30s now. You could see 2024.
Don't listen to your pa. Don't listen to your pa. Listen to me. I did it once. Your father
exactly.
Did it.
In his late 40s.
I'll show you where all the Jews are. Show you where the Jews are buried. Couldn't help myself.
God.
Cliffy.
For old time's sake, you have to.
Cliff, I think that more or less wraps up the year, buddy.
I mean, that's amazing. Should we make predictions? I predicted Alvin Grimes wins the Senate seat next year.
There you go.
Just kidding. I'm doubling down on that. I'm tripling down. I'm just kidding.
What's
going to happen next year, Sam? What do you think?
Well, don't start with me. I still got a couple more days. This is.
I've already predicted. I think Congress will pass through, and we will become buddy buddy with Cuba soon. You, as I said, will be going down to check out baseball prospects.
Okay.
Smoking some good cigars. I think you're right. On
how many government shutdowns will we have next year? Will we have one or none?
I don't think we're going to have any. I think we're not going to have any because I think that they are going to, on the right, they're going to give in enough. And I think people like Rand Paul, in other words, the establishment Republicans are going to give in to people on the right and sort of do what they've always done, which is basically say, you know, thank you, sir. May I have another? But Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and others who are running for president are going to realize that, and they tend to control that wing of the party, that a shutdown is not in their interests if they want to have a shot at winning the presidency. So I think they are going to find ways to just magically compromise, although not make it look like a compromise. So I'm going to go with no shutdowns.
John Boehner remains as the Speaker of the House?
I think he may get chucked. I'm going to go with that. I think John Boehner's time is coming.
Boom.
Yeah, that'll be the big one I'm going to throw out there. I think Boehner's toast. McConnell hangs in there because Rand Paul needs him.
Right.
And so that's going to get some Tea Party support. So McConnell will probably get a couple of votes against him, which will be very unusual.
So wait, who supplants Boehner?
That's the open question, and I don't know right now because I think a couple people are going to emerge.
Are they pushing like that guy Troy Gowdy or whatever his name is?
He's one that they're talking about, yeah. I think it's going to be somebody who's
a
crazier version
like
of Boehner.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, who are they going to put? That the whip that they have now, his name escapes me, was sort of notoriously bad at his job. McCarthy was, I think it was.
I don't think it's McCarthy. I don't. I could see him being majority. You know, I mean, as a majority leader, fine. As a speaker, I don't think so. But you know, somebody often comes out of the woodwork who you're not even thinking about. So I don't follow to those guys. All those mouth breathers are almost the same to me. You know, it's hard for me to tell them apart. So I don't really know. But I think Boehner is the one, because they're going to want to sort of take out their retribution on somebody, and they're not going to be able to do it to McConnell.
I'm just going by right-wing talk radio. That's the only thing that makes me even ask that question. You know, I haven't seen anybody writing about it.
They're pushing for it?
Oh, yeah, big time.
I assumed, yeah. Well, they consider this deal that they hate from the right, the Cromney bus, they blame that on Boehner.
Yep.
They're not blaming it on McConnell. Again, I think they realize McConnell is ensconced and they can't get him out of there because of his alliance with Rand Paul. So it's going to end up being Boehner.
Yeah, and it could very well be that Boehner is signaling that he wants out of there because happy hour is starting to run out. So
exactly. He's going to smoke a couple extra cigarettes. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if he just resigns and finally becomes actually starts getting paid as a lobbyist as opposed to just being one.
Right.
You know, and going on nice golf trips.
No more pro bono for me. All right, Cliff.
Exactly.
As always.
No more pro boner for.
No,
there was a joke in there somewhere, and I'm not sure I got it right. But.
All right, Cliff. As always, thank you so much for coming on this program every week and wrapping up the week for us. You made 2014 as special as you did 13 and 12.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me on. And everybody, happy holidays and New Year and all that fun stuff. And we'll be back to wrap up weeks.
And I'll give you a call in the next couple of days. We'll touch base by the end of the year just to see where we are.
Yeah, just maybe while I'm on the way to New York or on the way to Michigan, we'll cross paths in sort of Pennsylvania or something.
Fantastic. Cliff Schechter, right. Have a great New Year. We'll talk to you in 2015.
All right. Look forward to it. Take care.
All right, folks, I'm going to take a quick break. And when we come back, on the heels of his debut, a re-debut, or I don't know, re-inauguration of the best show no longer on WFMU, Tom Sharpling will be joining us. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe it was in 2014 or maybe 2013? At one point, I don't know. Time has collapsed for me. Something very sad happened. Tom Sharpling, who had been doing the best show on WFMU for 13 years, at least 13 or 14 years, depending on what. Went silent, but he has returned. Isn't that right, Tom Sharpling?
It is right, Sam. It is right. The best show is indeed back.
It is.
How about that?
It is back. That's exciting.
It is exciting. I'm excited. It took all year to do it.
What took you so long?
Well,
when did it go off the air? Was it at the end of 2013? Was it literally a year ago?
Pretty much it went off the air one day. It went off the air December 17th, and we did the first new show December 16th. So.
Oh, all right. Well, there's some symmetry there, I guess.
Yeah, pretty dramatic.
Wow.
So,
welcome to internet casting, buddy.
Oh, thank you. It's exciting to be here. the first time you ever said welcome to anything to me was after I had sunk about $1,200 into a Midnight Pajama Jam video, and it was ill-fated, I guess is the proper way to describe what happened to it. And you said, welcome to show business.
I remember the show. John Benjamin somehow convinced you to bankroll. Listen, let me tell you something about investing in John Benjamin, okay? Investing anything in John Benjamin. He still owes me hundreds of dollars from our electricity bill from living in Somerville, Massachusetts 22 years ago. And somehow Sharpling, and this was like what, like in 2002?
Something like that. It must have been the very early. I was doing the radio show at that point. It must have been 2002, 2003 at the latest.
And somehow Benjamin convinced you to shoot and produce a DVD of his show. And I just remember thinking like, oh, God. I don't think you understand what you have stepped into.
I did not understand what I stepped into. And now I think another decade has passed, and I'm stepping into another thing that I don't understand what I stepped into. What are you going to do?
You and I have a similar problem, right? Like that we're like
we're
cottage.
Losers.
Yes, we're
we're losers. We don't sit with the winners, and the winners just keep winning.
That's right.
And we keep trying to find ways to qualify our things as wins. As a way to not want to jump off a roof.
I'll tell you something. The only thing that I think we should be celebrating is that somehow you and I both did not manage in the late, in the early 90s to get into the typewriter business.
Yeah, that's the only thing that we did not go heavy on Corona
stuff. I think like investing in radio on some level. But, I mean, you know, podcasts are very big now, though. I mean, that's.
I heard about the cereal. It's very exciting. Apparently, that podcasts are a thing now.
Have you listened? Have you listened to cereal?
No, I have no time. But I don't even have anything against it. But now that everybody's frustrated with it, it's like, okay, well, that I just saved 13 hours of my life, I guess, by not listening to this thing that you're all bummed out about.
You know, I listen to it, and I don't listen to podcasts that often, but I've like my resolution for 2015 is to sort of just be to jump into the medium a little bit. I mean, NPR has that advantage in that their shows are so well produced. There's so much money that they spend on each one of their radio shows that they make for very good podcasts. But what struck me was like all of the advertisers that I hear on that serial, which is the biggest podcast ever, whatever.
By miles.
By miles.
Yeah,
are the same people who have advertised on this show. Like, you know, like the model still has not broken out. It's all sort of, somewhat, it's not penis pumps and gold, but it is.
It's not Ford.
Right.
Or,
exactly.
Or Coca-Cola.
Right.
They're still staying so far away from this thing that just like, we'll wait to, I think we'll stay with football games.
Right. Exactly.
It's.
All right. So tell us about, I don't know, people should be familiar with your show, but here's my question for you now. Like, what is the show called? The best show. And that's it. Not on
best
anything.
Show.
Why not the best show on the internet?
Well, that sounds like such a qualifier. That's no fun. Like,
but you used to be the best show on WFMU. I mean, is it really?
Yeah, but it was.
Can you really take that leap? I mean, from one station to everything? Better than cereal?
Okay, so it's even better than cereal. I named it before cereal started, so I might have to make it the second best show after cereal. I actually don't know why I'm picking on cereal. I have nothing against this thing.
Oh, come on. What do you have? Let me tell you, because you're when you get on radio, you get a little bit acerbic. But you are, you're like a sort of like a gentle giant in some ways.
Well, thank you. I mean,
you're a very, very, you know, like you're very, very, just sort of, because you would hang around with comedians, right? For, I mean, that's when I met you, and musicians too, and that's probably where you get that.
Sure. I just wasn't a lapdog for comedians. I was a lapdog for musicians too.
Well, maybe that's why you weren't, like, you know, usually people who hang around with comedians, particularly back then, back in the day when we first met. Now when you hang around with comedians, I think social media has ruined it, and we've talked about this a little bit before. But, but comedians were acerbic and mean, and you were never like that. So what I want from you now is I want you to, what do you have against who? I mean, you don't have anything against Serial, but then who do you have something against?
Oh, look, all I do is complain about people on the radio. It's just a 3-hour moan fest about me just wondering why I don't have what other people have.
But I think some of that's contrived. I want the real story.
The real story. Well, name names, and I'll go thumbs up or thumbs down.
All right. Well, let's see. Let's do this. Let's start with Marin. Come on.
What? He's great. He's been a very good friend, and him and Brendan McDonald have just been.
Well, no, Brendan's great.
Yeah,
Brendan's
no,
great.
Of course Brendan's great.
Brendan's great.
I still can't believe you have not sat down across from him for an hour-long conversation yet.
That's what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear at least Marin called to the somebody tweet this out immediately that Tom Sharpling just called out Mark Marin for not having him on his program.
I didn't call him out.
Well,
you're on 11 of his live shows, but he hasn't sat down face to face with you yet, which I feel like should be the 1,000th episode of WTF. Like, I don't know what could top that.
How many episodes have they done, though, at this point?
I think they're in the 500s now.
So I got to wait another four years.
So just hang in there, buddy. It's 2019, kind of right around the corner.
My God, that's like... It's like literally at that point, he'll be walking around with the people doing the census, going through, doing interviews, and then we get to Cedar.
Yeah, well, that's where I'll be after this thing goes belly up.
Now, come on, the amazing thing that why your show was so perfect for what you're doing now was that it seems to me that by the time you were wrapping up that show, most of your callers, I mean, you would still obviously, because you were on terrestrial radio, you were getting people to listen in terms of terrestrially, but you had, I would say the ratio was dramatically different than any other sort of local show in any format anywhere in terms of how many people listened across the country versus actually on their AM dial or FM dial.
There was a point when it flipped. The show started as a thing that felt local. And when I listened to WFMU before I was on the station, and even part of when I was on it, it was a local. It was radio. It was you. If you didn't hear it on a radio, you didn't hear it.
Well, there was no internet. I mean, streaming at that time was all dial up, if I remember correctly.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the show started in 2000 and. But I would say around 2005, when we started podcasting the show, and that's when the shift really happened. When suddenly it was not about who was listening over their radio, and it was about who was listening on their computer or iPod, and it just kept the gulf. I feel like kept growing and growing, and the one part of the being on WFMU that I could not replicate in some form is the part that I might be least interested in right now, which is being over broadcast terrestrial radio.
How much do you miss? I mean, and maybe this wasn't an issue for, because, you know, when I, the one thing I missed about being on terrestrial radio, and, you know, we replay this, but being live on terrestrial radio is having people accidentally stumble onto the show and call in. Now, for me, it was like, you know, the people who would accidentally stumble on the show would be right wingers who want to have an argument with me. And as you know, Tom, I'm a little bit argumentative. And that's the one thing I miss. I mean, on some level, YouTube provides some of that for us now. But was that ever a big part? I mean, I feel like there were times where you would get calls like, I don't know what you're doing, buddy.
Look, that's good. Yeah, that will, nobody's going to get it by flipping through the dial. I guess, if people talk about it enough on social media, we'll still get people coming to check it out and
right.
being like, what is this thing? So it'll probably, we'll get some version of that. And I also feel like we got much less of that just because as the show grew and people who knew what the show was started calling, there's less of a chance for those people to even get through. They'll just get a busy signal, and then just the odds were they were going to get a busy signal.
Right.
So it wasn't the thing it was at the beginning of the show. I also, look, I'm cut from a different cloth than you, Sam, in terms of I'm not a prankster. I'm not in it to get a rise out of people. To just kind of tease them or lead them down a path that they don't realize they're being laughed at, not with. That's not my speed.
That's not your speed.
It's not.
I mean, it seems to me that is like, that is exactly your speed. That is, you are a completely calibrated, like you came off the assembly line.
I might be doing it right now.
Yes, exactly. Now, I should also remind people, and you know what? I mean, I guess I assume that people knew this because, I mean, you've been on this program before, but some of my most catastrophic failures started because of you in my life, I should say. One being that you mentioned that the show started in 2000, and I don't think I realized that, but I think I was on – like you're, when did you start? Like in November of 2000?
October 2000.
I was on your show the night that of the election in 2000. And,
right.
And I had called in to do a character I was doing around town, Joe Lieberman's fake son. I think at that time I called it Al Lieberman. And I was watching the election returns. It was still early in the evening. And I was talking about how my father wouldn't let me campaign, that I was from West Palm Beach in Florida. And, you know, this was before the election results came in. So we didn't know about Florida at this point. It was like at 8 o'clock at night, I think, when I called in. I remember where I was sitting in my apartment. And Janine Garofalo and I think Eric Sloven were watching the returns. And I was just staying on the phone. And you were letting me talk for forever.
We had a lot of show to fill.
I think because of what happened just like 5 hours later, that combination of that character being from West Palm Beach and the election turning West Palm Beach, I went and spent a tremendous amount of money.
Half of the following decade was dedicated to you chasing this story that
I made a bad situationist, which turned into a disaster in about four different ways. I've spoken about that movie. And then, like two or three years later, you were the one who launched the Majority Report. This is in February of 2003. John Benjamin and I came over to the studio. You gave me 2 hours. Benjamin did the live read there. And and Janine called in as a guest, and I beat up on some like Fox and Friends.
Yeah, some like guy who did like Saturday nights on Fox News at that point, and had no idea. Was just happy to get that anybody wanted to talk to him. Suddenly, he's like, oh, so this guy's just not letting me. Breathe here.
I totally ambushed him. I totally ambushed him.
Yeah, you were.
I feel like we were all afraid to leave the studio that night, too.
There was a lot of fear around at that point. in the general. I remember just being scared of... that's one thing that I don't think anybody remembers, or maybe... it's just the effect of just paranoia that was... Because nobody... Now it's so easy to say. It's like, oh, look, nothing else happened after 9/11. But it's like everybody then was just like, hey, is one of these going to happen every week?
Right.
And that feeling went on for years. And then it finally dissipated probably. And that probably took 5 years for people to finally, like, exhale a little bit.
But it wasn't just that. It wasn't that. I remember that we were worried that somebody was going to come to the studio and beat me up or, you know, shoot of us.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, that was a specific example, but there was this constant fear running through everything. So I think it heightened individual
yes.
moments. It made them even more, it made you think of everything through the lens of what's going to happen to me here. With
right.
this, like, am I gonna get my ass beat as soon as I step out? And I would have times like that. There were people who would make like creepy calls, and then there'd be like a truck out front of the station with its headlights on, and just like when that street was as desolate as can be, and there'd just be a truck parked right across the street from the entrance to the station. I was terrified. That happened. And it was also spooky. That whole area was spooky because that's where all of the Ground Zero workers, so much of the people parked there, and then
right.
there were so many trucks on that side of the Hudson that it just even though you're in New Jersey, we're still three blocks from the water, and it just added this kind of like this constant reminder of just the you could have looked to the right and seen the reminder of it, but also just the. Vehicles parked everywhere. It felt like you were in the middle of a construction zone.
Right.
You were in New Jersey. Really. Those were strange times.
Very strange times. Very strange times.
And now everything's better, though.
Well, now let me ask you. What is really bad that's going on now? I mean, I wanted to ask you like this sort of this broad sort of like what is really like a broad trend in culture that is you think is problematic? I mean, one of the things that I mean, well, go ahead. I mean, you tell me. I mean, because I know you think about this stuff.
I don't know. I think just personal privacy is on all fronts is something that's dying off, and it's just a hard thing if you grew up with it to watch it go away, and just that the presumption that goes on with people, like just like the presumption that goes when you go buy anything and people ask for your social security number, and it's like why are you asking? And then just like that, because then it's in the it's in the system then. And they don't even know why they are asking, even but
right.
they ask, and it's just like little things. The way that stuff has creeped into just the smallest parts of everyday life, but then can also have these overarching consequences. To me, is a huge bummer.
So the data we're living in the data age, where we're just mined for our data.
Just that, yeah. That really, to me, is something I just. I do miss how it was, and I think that there's a trade-off that, computers were, everybody was sold on these things as if it was going to make everybody's life easier. And it's like, I can't say that my life got easier because of it. There's things I have more access to.
Right.
But it definitely did not get easier. It got more complicated because of this stuff.
Yeah, well, I think that's always been the case with technology. We're always sold with technology is going to, at this point we should be working, 3 days a week, and we really need to figure out how to work with our leisure time. And instead,
exactly. it's heading towards the great society, and it just suddenly now everybody's just on the hook around the clock. And
yes.
If you don't have your phone on at 1 a.m, then somehow you're dodging people.
I got to say the one thing, and I wanted to, you know, we touched on this last time I think you were on, and I wanted to bring it up again because I've thought about it a little bit more about the sort of what's happening culturally in terms of, you know, the within the sort of the comedy world on some level. And I mean, I think I touched on this last time about like that social media to me has really the one thing that it has really inhibited, I think, is good cultural criticism by people particularly like, you know, of our ilk and more sort of like the comedian ilk. Like you can't get away with being critical of people who have had success. I mean, Andy Kindler does it quite a bit, I got to say. He's one of the few people I still see doing it. And it sticks out.
Yeah. Absolutely, he looks like a troublemaker or an outlaw, because he'll just say, "Hey, I don't like this guy, and I'm going to goof on him." And
that used to be, that to me used to be like the idea that he sticks out so much for doing that is, yeah, I think, indicative of a problem that is out there, because now it just sort of feels like. And particularly even more so with a younger generation of comedians that and you know that you can't really afford to alienate people because they are doing you know they help you they could help your career by just giving you a good tweet and driving people to your YouTube channel.
There is a part of it. It feels like a tight. It is a balancing act where it's like, yeah, you don't know who you're going to work with 5 years from now, and if you savage them on some thing in the middle of the night that you're now you can't ever undo. But there's also a thing where I feel like everybody's. There is like this niceness to comedy now that it's either you're overly nice or you're just the worst person ever, where you're just like a monster and you're just like, you're basically, you know what I mean? Where you're either squeaky clean or you're one of those just terrifying stand-ups who just say anything. And just don't care about anything. They'll say the worst thing.
Right. You're either out there to shock people, or you're just so benign and that it's meaningless. And that's what I'm saying, is like it is destroying any type of like thoughtful criticism because you pay such a price. And you know, comedians are the ones who are supposed to, in some way, be the cops on the beat for sort of these cultural things, and they can't really afford to be anymore, it seems like.
Not in those things, because everybody is also on, and I feel it from both sides, where it's like, if somebody says something negative to me, it's like, yeah, look, nobody likes seeing something negative said to them. Like, but if I'm going to have opinions on things, I'm going to like some things and not like other things, and people have these absolute same right to feel that way about me, to like me or not like me. I can't act like it's a one-way street. But it also comes down to this thing where just like the people can say the things to the people now, and everybody's on the same thing. Everybody's on the same platform.
Right.
And so if I all of a sudden start goofing on I start goofing on like the Fargo miniseries, and there's probably 10 people on that thing on Twitter who could see that in 5 minutes, and then just like now I'm not only just saying it to the public, I'm saying it to the people who make the thing,
right?
Which is not exactly the intent of things like that. Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like the goal is not to make people feel bad about the jobs that they took to do things. It's just like, it's the goal is you want to express yourself to just the public, not, but it reaches everybody simultaneously. So it's a real tricky thing. I have
it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it is weird. And it's almost, I can see why certain people go on social media and they just kind of perform and don't actually express themselves. You can see why people do it, but it's unfortunate that that's where it's at, that there's nothing thoughtful about it, which is why I also just, I choose to wait till I'm on the radio to talk about these things rather than to try to.
That's right.
I know I can walk through the whole thing and explain every angle of a thing and show how I feel about it and this, I feel this way. You can't do that on Twitter. It's going to come out. You said that you're going to say one thing or another thing. It's just like there's nothing nuanced about tweets.
Yeah, so. I think, I tend to tweet a lot less because I'm going to talk about it, whatever it is, on a daily basis. It does.
Exactly. It's the best place for you. You're going to do the best version of that discussion on your show.
Exactly. All right. Well, Tom, this is where I ask you to recommend your favorite Bill Cosby movie.
Probably Ghost Dad.
Something to watch. Give me an idea of of what to watch on streaming. I guess the interview is not out yet, right? I wanted to talk to you.
We're a week away. It's gonna be in theaters in a week.
You think it's gonna be? No.
I can't wait.
I was gonna
go to the premiere last night. Was actually, I never get to go to anything ever, and then I got invited by a friend to go with him to the premiere last week. So I'm just like, oh, I'm going to finally get to go to a thing. And then I think I, on some part, am responsible for what happened to this thing because I'm not supposed to go to nice things.
Maybe that's what it was all about. Maybe all the other stuff, like the North Korea stuff, is just a ruse. It's just as soon as word got out, Sharpling was going to his first premiere.
In 11 years, I needed to be reminded of my status. Do you think it comes out? When do you think that comes out? You just had to put a date on it.
Well, I don't think it's going to come out in theaters, but I think that they'll release it. I don't know, probably in 3 months, 4 months on iTunes, Netflix, whatever, some big streaming service. Maybe they'll shuffle it off to some subsidiary,
they'll recoup. Try More Productions presents.
Exactly.
The interview.
Sani Productions or something.
Or Kobe. What if they get that company that makes the knockoff DVD players, Kobe?
Yeah.
And Kobe puts the interview out.
Exactly. Quasar.
Well, movie-wise, I liked, if you're home.
Yeah.
I guess you could watch Blowout.
Blowout
is Blowout. Have you ever seen Blowout?
Is that this is from the 70s or the 60s? Is this the one about the photographer? 70s. Right.
No, that's Blow Up.
Oh, no. I don't know if I know Blowout then.
Blowout is a Brian De Palma movie that is
Travolta?
Travolta.
Yes. Okay, I haven't seen it in ages, but I do remember it.
Crazy! It's on Criterion now, and it's just I hadn't seen it in a million years, and I watched it again, and it's really it's pretty great and kind of ridiculous at the same time, but I enjoyed watching it a lot because it's like one of the last of those stagey kind of movies where there'll be scenes with rear projection of them driving in a car, but then having real rear projection when they, and then just 5 minutes later there'll be actual stunts that it's they could have done better than the rear projection. So they're all choices.
They had to do pickups.
Yeah, it's Brian De Palma in full Hitchcock tribute mode with that stuff. So. I like it a lot, and it's funny to see John Travolta as an actor. You just see him in a thing, and you're just oh, wow, he was once just like a dude who just starred in movies and that would just star in another movie. And now he's just like this mess that you couldn't think of wanting to see a movie with him in it now. And then, but then it was just like, oh, he was a movie star.
I love it. An early John Travolta. All right, now, so what's the rest of the schedule? Your show again on Tuesday nights, right?
Tuesday nights at thebestshow.net. So you can go there, and it's on iTunes and all the places like that.
Are you going to be on Christmas Eve?
Well, it'll be the 23rd.
Oh, yeah. Okay, wait. So when's Christmas? It's the 25th. Okay.
Yeah, Christmas. You're not that Jewish to where you didn't know the date.
I always get confused on what day Christmas is, honestly.
Like the war on Christmas, that was a shot across the bow.
Oh yeah, no, I'm full effect. So 23rd.
Nobody's talking about the war on Christmas this year. It doesn't seem like it has any traction at all.
No, resonance this year on the war on Christmas. They have to. I think, you know, the thing is with the war on Christmas, you need to have Republicans in office because they can't be mad about anything else. So they sort of have to move it more cultural. Now there's all sorts of things. You know, President Obama's a dictator and, you know, he's cavorting with Fidel Castro, and you know he's letting the unwashed hordes into the country. So you know who's got time for the war on Christmas? But when we're in the middle of a war in Iraq, and you don't want to talk about the president, it's the war on Christmas. That's the way that works. So we may not see it for decades, but it'll come.
Unless the war is over, unless that's one of the only wars that has concluded, maybe Christmas won.
Christmas may have won, but I'm still fighting it here. I can tell you that right now.
You're still fighting
the last Japanese soldier.
Oh, and I'm looking on Twitter, and now I see some dimwit saying, "Mark Maron, you've been called out." Oh, stop! Like. Like now, I need to walk this back.
No, we don't have time.
I'm going to walk it back for all weekend on Twitter now.
We're having technical difficulties. Sorry, okay. No time for your walking back. I gotta get on the Twitter right now and retweet that. Tom Sharpling, thebestshow.net. I will be listening next Tuesday and then the following Tuesday and then the one after that and on and on and on. I'm so glad that you're back on doing your show. It was sorely missed.
I appreciate it. Thanks. And thanks for having me on.
All right.
And, happy holidays to you.
Oh, well, thank you. That is very appropriate for you to say. And to you too, sir. Have a wonderful winter equinox.
To you too. And, enjoy the upcoming solstice.
I will. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, take care.
There it is, folks, Tom Sharpling. And ladies and gentlemen, what very well may be our final Jimmy Reefer Cake song of the year. Let's hear it before we go. This Freebie Friday is crazy because we know I'm going to go and do another 45 minutes of member show. So this is just out of control. Unbelievable.
This Jimmy Reefer Cake song is called Milk Toast Man.
Okay.
Yeah, Milk Toast Man, Milk Toast Man, will you ever take a stand? I ask you, do you understand? You only help the Republican. Paula Page is the worst governor in the USA. The economy sucks and he's taking more benefits away. But you take some toast, you let it soak in milk, and tell me what you get. A mushy, mushy, mushy mess when you let that toast get wet. No more milk toast, like I said. Won't you take them out to the woodshed? I think Stephen King agrees, but is it Toby saying, more milk toast, please? I just want to know, Toby, are you a Republican? In Long Island, we all really know that someone really screwed up, or maybe made a mistake on purpose when they picked them 21 votes up. It was the State House Republicans who voted to keep their friggin' gal. I can only wonder if you're serving up milk toast just to try to be their pal. Ah, no more milk toast, like I said. Take them out to the woodshed. Please serve us some lean protein. I'm not saying that you gotta be mean. I'm just saying no more milk toast, please.
No more milk toast, please. I'm not 100% sure I fully get what it was referring to, but I like the song.
Are we playing La Poupée, or should we just go right into the better half without it?
Oh, yeah. Let's play La Poupée. So, folks, well, final Friday, but not final show. So, oh, good. Goodbye. Yeah, whatever. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920.
This is your last chance to get in best of.
Oh, yeah.
This weekend, once Sunday's over, that's it. We're not taking any more best of suggestions.
That's right. Give us a best of suggestion for 2014. You can either be a segment, it could be something from the better half, it could be something, an interview, whatever you want. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM me by using the app, at majorityapp.com. Be right back.